we compared a lump sum amount of money sent at once and then money sent on a monthly basis over time. And after 2 years, we compared what is happening in those communities. And we saw that if you give people lump sum amounts of money, they immediately take big decisions, big investments, and they change their lives very quickly.
If you've ever been surprised by your own thoughts, well, you're not alone. From the time we're born to the time we die, we spend our lives meeting strangers, including the one within. We also spend our lives learning about many of those strangers and turning them into colleagues, friends, and family. In this podcast, host Charlie Bressler talks with fascinating people on their musings about family, community, work, helping others, and getting to know the stranger inside ourselves. Where do we fit in the world we all inhabit together? Charlie Bressler, the co-founder of The Life You Can Save and former president of a large international retail company, investigates ideas that he has been musing on since he obtained his PhD in clinical and social psychology way back in 1984.
My guest today is Caroline Tetti, the Africa Director of Recipients Advocacy at the nonprofit GiveDirectly. Caroline wore her first pair of shoes when she was 12. Being raised in a small village 250 kilometers west of Nairobi, Kenya. In this episode, she muses on her journey from extreme poverty to a leader at GiveDirectly, where she helps to safely and efficiently deliver hundreds of millions of dollars of cash directly to families just like the one she grew up in. This is a fascinating conversation because Caroline's story and her extraordinarily articulate telling of it is awe-inspiring. I hope you'll enjoy it as much as I did. Well, Caroline, it's great to have you on Musings About Ourselves and Other Strangers and to finally meet one-on-one. I've been following your work for quite some time now, but I appreciate your willingness to be on the podcast.
Thank you so much, Charlie, for having me. It's a pleasure.
And I'm in the Pacific Northwest in America. And where are you taking this call today?
Today, I am picking this call from Goma, DRC. As you may know, right now, there's a lot of fears around conflict in Eastern DRC. That's exactly where I am.
Are you safe or as safe as you usually are?
I am safe. I am in good hands and I am safe.
Well, what I'd like to do is to have the audience get to know you a little bit better. So starting with your childhood and where you grew up and how you got into doing the work that you're doing at GiveDirectly, if you don't mind. And feel free to expand and don't feel like you have to cut it short.
I'm Caroline Tetti. Today I exist as Caroline Tetti. I work at GiveDirectly as one of the directors and I'm overseeing our safeguarding and advocacy work. I was born and brought up in rural Kenya, in Western Kenya, in a place called Kisumu. My dad still lives there, but unfortunately, my mom died when I was 10 years old. So mostly I grew up under the care of my father and my stepmother, who have been really, really nice to me. Growing up, Charlie, in rural Kenya is a story of itself. And I have grown up seeing, knowing, and experiencing some of the things we call poverty today. As I grew up, I can tell you that didn't occur to me that that was actually poverty that I was living. I was just making life happen. My parents were trying to make life happen. We work in the farms. We look for food. Sometimes that food is not there. We climb trees of fruits that my dad has grown. We take the fruits, go back to school. Actually, if you asked me, the first time I wore a shoe was when I was 12 years old, as I was going to join high school. So all that while, for 12 years of my life, I walked barefoot, going to school and coming back. Challenges in between were quite many. That said, in my heart, I knew that there was a better world, there was a better experience, and one of the ways that I could get there was through education. So as we struggled with my siblings, with other children in the community, We were struggling in different ways with different perspectives. Others ended up differently, worse than they were when we were kids. But I knew in my heart that there was one thing that I had to work for, which was getting myself out of this situation through very, very focused education. So I really took my education seriously in everything that I was doing. Education was a very important milestone for me. Every step that I managed to take, it meant a lot to me in terms of just rewriting my life story and changing the life of my family, my siblings, and living a better life in future.
Why do you think education became so important to you at such an early age? Was it your parents? Was it something you came to on your own?
One is my parents. My parents believed a lot in education. My dad himself really, really valued education, and he encouraged us to go to school. And the fact that my dad was, you know, living with us in the village was not a factor of him not going to school. He went to school, he worked a bit, but he lost his job. He was retrenched at some point when I was 11 years old. My mom died when I was 10. My dad lost his job when I was 11. I know that my dad knew what it meant to go to school and the value that it came with. For me also, leaving home every day and going to school, I could see in the village that there were very few career people who I was interacting with. So in the villages, the careers that you'd interact with mostly would be teachers, nurses, police officers, because those are the work cadres that would have to be deployed up to the most remote parts of the country. And one denominator that they had in common is these people had to go to school. So you would ask, if you want to become a teacher, what do you do? The first thing you'd be told is go to school first. I knew that there was something about going to school that was very, very important. I think the other advantage that I got was that going to school at a very early age gave me an opportunity. Mostly in Kenya, in high school, people join at 14, 15 years old. I joined high school at 12, so I was 2 years earlier than my age mates. And that also gave me an opportunity to start learning things very early and form that perspective in life very early.
And your friends in the village, most of them stopped going to school at some point. How many of your friends were able to continue on into high school?
I remember when I was in primary school, we were 15 of us. And of the 15 of us, I think only 7 of us managed to go to high school. The other remaining 8 dropped out, either because they didn't have school fees or they didn't make for the qualifications that they needed to go to high school. Of the ones who went to high school, if I remember today, it's only 2 of us who are in formal employment. And I know that I have 4 of my colleagues who we were with in primary school who have since died. They died young, as young parents. They're no more.
What were the causes of death? Was it something related to illnesses that could be treated if they were elsewhere? Or?
Yeah. Most of them died out of treatable illnesses. One woman died out of intimate partner violence. She died in the hands of her husband.
You went to high school, and then what followed on from high school? Because you continued on with your education.
I went to high school, and luckily I also did very well, and I got admission into university. My admission into university actually was the reason that I stepped into the big city for the very first time. I had never been to the big city. So my first time visiting Nairobi was when I was going into university. And I remember going into university to register. I didn't know where the university was. I didn't know a relative. I didn't know any place I could stay. And my home was 254 kilometers from Nairobi. So it meant that I would take a night bus, go to the university, get there very early in the morning, and make sure I do everything that I needed to do in that day to submit my admission document and get back to the next night bus the same night. So I did not have to look for a place to sleep or someone to take care of me. And I just had to go back home. Long story short, I managed to study at the university, got a bachelor's degree in English and literature and education, proceeded to be employed with the government of Kenya as a teacher in a high school in one of the villages, taught there for 4 years, after which then I proceeded to go to, actually resigned from my teaching job to go for further education. I enrolled in Nairobi again, did master's in development communication at Daystar University in Nairobi. While at Daystar, I started cutting my teeth in the NGO sector, working with an organization that was actually, I was literally an intern mobilizing people to come in for trainings. You see the way people are invited to do trainings? I would literally be sent to walk all over Nairobi, walk from office to office, talk to people, ask them if they could accept to take this training. Could they pay it? And that was my first stint in the nonprofit sector. After that, I went in to work with a parliamentary network where I was coordinating parliamentarians in Kenya to promote youth and women's reproductive health rights and needs. While doing that, I was also still doing my master's studies at Daystar.
When you were working with the parliamentarians, what were the things that were successful and what were the big challenges you faced in working with these individuals, if there were any, which I imagine there were?
This was very young in my career. I was, I think, about 24, 25. The role actually involved mobilizing members of parliament, one, to meetings, and two, to sign off on documents and agreements, and also to pass legislations in parliament to help move the agenda for youth and women's reproductive health. Some of the successes that I can say happened there was being able to secure funding to run the network for a year and a half. And then we also managed to, for the very first time, we had a national youth policy signed off in Kenya. We had the very first reproductive health and HIV/AIDS integrated policy signed in Kenya. During that time, we also had for the very first time a budget line for reproductive health on the Kenyan national budget, which was never there. We managed to have these members of parliament go with us into communities to sensitize communities, mobilize young people, teach them about reproductive health, and take resources down to those communities. Those for me were real, real successes.
At that time, what was the average age of women's first pregnancy?
Around that time, we were really struggling with, number one, sexual debut among girls was starting at around 14 years. At 18, 19, women had already had children. To be sincere with you, Charlie, I also got my first baby when I was 18 years. So I knew what this meant. I got a baby when I was in university. I was married, got my firstborn child, and I was 18. I was lucky in different ways than most girls are, which can be a story also. From the age of 15, girls could easily get pregnant. And most of the adolescent pregnancies were out of wedlock, abandoned with those children to take care of them. So that became a really big problem. And what it meant is that then girls would drop out of school because of pregnancy. As I told you, girls joined high school at the age of 14, 15. So it means at the age of 14, 15, if you've had your sexual debut, it's also possible that you'll get pregnant around that time, which also means that you'd drop out of school around that time, which means you're going to be struggling to bring up another human being without an income, without a proper education, without a self-sustaining livelihood. So those are some of the things that we were trying to address.
So after you were doing that work, you moved into some different work. Can you explain what you did after that?
I continued working in the reproductive health space. I moved into another nonprofit that was doing reproductive health. And this was mostly reproductive health advocacy and also reproductive health governance and programming. We designed programs for women in communities. We were in governance for reproductive health. What do we need decision makers to do to change the systemic problems of reproductive health for women in Kenya? I took 8 months in that job. And then I moved to another organization where I was managing a program, a water and sanitation program for rural primary schools in Kenya.
Were you living in Nairobi at that time?
Yes. After university, I moved to Nairobi. I was married when I was in university. My husband and my kids were all in Nairobi. Before I went into this work, while I was in the reproductive health space, I also managed to get a sponsorship to take a diploma in gender and human rights in Sweden. So I spent some time in Sweden studying gender and human rights law in the hope that I could advance the reproductive health work and women's rights advocacy. Then I moved into water and sanitation, where we were building both hardware facilities for water and sanitation for schools in Western Kenya. And we were also doing sensitizations and trainings for schools, basically hygiene education. After that work, I came back to Nairobi to work again back into reproductive health. So I went into reproductive health advocacy in the African Union, East African Community, IGAD, the UN, European Parliament, other parliaments in Europe, like German, Polish, Netherlands, at The Hague. We did a lot of advocacy, which was cross-country, working across about 14 countries in Africa and Asia. So I did that work for almost 3 years.
Must have meant an awful lot of travel during that period of time.
Yes, that was a lot of travel. Actually, one of the reasons that I stopped working there was because of travel, because I had a small baby, and not small, actually. She was just starting her primary school, and my travel was affecting her. So I needed to make the decision to get something that could get me closer and have more time with her. So then I went into the warming space, neglected tropical diseases. So I worked at Deworm the World Initiative, overseeing the project in Kenya, deworming 6 million children every year. I did this for 4 years, working with Ministry of Health in Kenya, Ministry of Education, the World Health Organization. Out of that program, we seeded a similar program in Ethiopia and also in Nigeria. All of those three programs are still running. After the deworming program, then I joined Give Directly, and today I'm counting 8 years since I joined and 4 different roles.
8 years since you joined, yes. Give Directly.
Hi, I'm Caroline Tetti, a director at Give Directly. I was born in the rural villages of Western Kenya, and so many charities show up disorganized and with limited supplies. It was dehumanizing to watch women scramble for food and other handouts. Instead, let's choose to help with dignity by choosing cash. Giving cash empowers people in extreme poverty to transform their own lives, giving them the freedom to make their own choices in the process. We are working with The Life You Can Save to accelerate the end of extreme poverty with cash transfers. You can join us at thelifeyoucansave.org/givedirectly.
I think it would be really informative for our listeners for you to describe the work that Give Directly does and also how you see it differing from other NGOs.
Absolutely. The fact that I've journeyed in different organizations, Charlie, means that I have seen a lot of ways in which aid is implemented and delivered to people living in extreme poverty. Even for me, when I was coming into Give Directly, I know Give Directly was very young at that time, but I was asking very many questions and I was like, which organization is this? At some point, I'm like, maybe they are donors, but which donors are donating money in villages? Donors should be giving money to people in the cities and they should be having their offices in the cities. But Give Directly was actually in the city where I was born, Kisumu. That is where we had our first headquarter office. For those who may not know what Give Directly does, we exist to advance unconditional cash to people living in extreme poverty, putting choice in the hands of people living in vulnerability by enabling them to make choices about their lives, not by defining what those choices should be. And for us to be able to do that, we raise resources from well-wishers and donors who have the same perspective and the same convictions as ours. And that money is sent to people directly into their hands using mobile phones. One of the things that has really worked for us is the growth of mobile telephony and the technology of mobile money, which has improved financial inclusion for people living in extreme poverty. Give Directly literally sends money directly in the hands of people living in poverty with the hope that we are giving them choice about their lives, empowering them to make decisions about their lives, and also giving them an opportunity to teach us what aid should be doing better.
When you tell people what you're doing who don't work for Give Directly or who are not part of that space, if you will, what is the primary response you get when you tell them you're just putting cash through the mobile network directly into people's hands?
Two things that most people ask us. Don't you train them on how to use the money? Caroline, how can you just give people money? Won't they waste it? And that is not just people coming from the West. Even back here at home, for people who've never worked with Give Directly, who've never seen unconditional cash being delivered in the way that we are doing it, the first thing is they think we are being too careless. They think that people who are living in extreme poverty need to be handheld, need to be taught, need to be shown what to do. And even you need to go back and tell them, if they make mistakes on how they use the money, you need to tell them, you have messed up. You should have used this money in this way or that way. The one thing that is wrong about that, it is the height of paternalism. Because we imagine that the decisions that we're making are the best and the decisions that poor people are making are the worst. We also imagine that we can define what can make their lives better by defining what they should do with money that we give them. So we literally are controlling them and making them live a life that is, I would say, a manifestation of our mental thinking of what the world should look like.
When people challenge you and say, but how do you know this is working? How do you know that people are using the money well? You observe it, but is there any way that you know for sure that this money is being well used? What is your response to that?
For people who are coming from Africa, the first thing I ask them is, do you ever send your mother money? Do you ever send your father money or your grandmother or your sister? Do you ever send the money? And the answer will be yes. Do you ever ask them how they use, or do you give them with a note that says, I'm going to send you $100 and this $100, I want you to spend it on 1, 2, 3 things. Do you ever do that? And they say no. And they say, why do you trust yourself to send your mom money and trust her to spend it well, yet you don't trust me to give her money and that she will spend it well? And they would be like, actually, now that you say it, it actually makes a lot of sense. And I'm like, yes. It makes a lot of sense that people who live in extreme poverty also live 24 hours like us. Those 24 hours must be lived with an experience. They have hope, they have dreams, they have choices, but they have an impediment. That impediment is money, which we are never there to give to them. When we do want to give it to them, we give it to them with strings attached, or we define what we need to give to them. We translate the money into clothes, houses, food, medical care. Yet we do not know if all of the people we are giving medical care actually needed medical care as the priority at the time when we're giving them the help. If you're coming from the West, I will ask you, for these many years that we have been doing aid, tell me what has pleased you the most about the successes of the aid industry. There is a lot that is going on. People continue asking themselves a lot of questions, yet poverty continues to increase. And then the next question that I ask is, what would you want people to do with that money? And the first thing you'd hear people say is, if you give them money, you want them to make more money out of that money, so you want them to make businesses. And I'm like, that's where you go wrong. Because you imagine that investing in a business is the only solution that can change somebody's life. So then I would give them examples of things that people have done with the money, which is not business, but which have been transformative. For example, getting cash from GiveDirectly and being able to construct a house, a tin-roofed house. For a lot of people, they say, but why are they building houses? I don't think it is necessary. I don't think it is important. I asked 3 different women who all built houses. And for them, a house meant totally different things. For one of them, it was security for her girls who had to walk in the dark to their grandfather's house to look for a place to sleep. The security of a girl, as you know, is very, very important in terms of life outcomes for girls. So a girl walking in darkness at night means she can be waylaid, she can be raped, she can be killed. Anything can happen to her. For a mother, that is enough to cause you sleepless nights. So for this woman, protecting her children was very, very important. And I can't tell you how many donors come out here and say, girl education, girl empowerment, girl safety. But do they know that just building a house for their mother will promise that safety? Nobody ever thinks about that. For the second woman, I asked her, why did you build a house? And she said, right now, I am having my 4th pregnancy. All of them have been birthed at home, which means she doesn't go to the hospital. Now, those are indicators of poverty. She birthed 3 children at home, and she was going to birth a 4th child at home. And all the 3 children, every time she wanted to go and give birth, she would go and beg the house of another woman. She's literally selling her privacy, her very personal, intimate life, to the space of somebody else. And for her, being able to have a house meant that, for the first time, she's able to deliver in dignity. I asked the 3rd woman, and I said, why did you build a house? And she said, my husband has 3 of us. his wives. We are living in the same house for years, and we have never known peace. We are fighting. We are grumbling. I don't have peace. I don't have privacy. I don't have what I need as a woman. My dignity is compromised because of the way I'm living with my co-wives. Having a house of my own gives me an opportunity to live a dignified life, a life of privacy, and a life where I can bring up my children in ways that gives me confidence and in ways that gives me autonomy as a parent. Nobody will ever tell you that in aid. Nobody ever will tell anyone who's giving money in aid that these are fundamental things. And some of the problems we try to address, they're addressed by very simple things. I'm going to tell you a last story of a man who lost his wife because the wife ran away with the children because he was drinking so much. He was a drunkard. When I went to that community and I talked to the man and asked him, can you tell me your story? And he said, this money has transformed my life. And you can even call the government officials in this area. They will tell you I am transformed because I left my house every morning and went to drink illicit brews in the village. I came back every evening a stupor. I could not know myself. If I fell in a ditch, if I fell on the road, if I fell on the grass, if I fell in my house, I would fall asleep and tomorrow the cycle begins. Now, what stopped this cycle? Why was he drinking this much? He was living in extreme poverty. He didn't have a bed. And he said, if I cannot even afford myself a bed, then the dignity of life is lost completely. I don't have any meaning in life. I'm better off sleeping in trenches, sleeping on grass outside, being rained on, sleeping on the floor. It's all the same. Whether I'm inside the house or I'm outside, it's meaningless. When he got money from Give Directly, he stopped drinking. He bought a mattress. He started a business. And to date, he's never tasted alcohol. Those are real stories of real humans.
Well, that is almost chilling to hear about. I have a question. How much money has Give Directly raised since it began that they've been able to put forward in cash transfers?
Today, we can say that we have hit $1 billion and we have sent money close to 2 million people.
Of that close to $1 billion, about how much of it actually gets directly to the recipients?
Our efficiency is very high. So it depends from one program to the next. On average, we would say between 85 to 90% of that money gets to recipients, depending on the design and the location of the program.
So 15% or less in what you might call overhead. If somebody challenges and said, well, I understand all of this about people using the money well, and your stories are really compelling, what scientific evidence do you have to support what you're saying, in essence? Do you have any evidence from a scientific basis?
Absolutely. We do have evidence, Charlie. We knew that we were getting into a space where people would have these questions. To date, we have run about 20 randomized controlled trials asking different questions about unconditional cash, each of those giving us very positive outcomes about things that people do. Just very recently, we have just released a study which was asking questions about sending a basic income to people living in extreme poverty. So we have this project that is going to be sending people money for 12 years every month for every adult in recipient villages. And we compared a lump sum amount of money sent at once and then money sent on a monthly basis over time. And after 2 years, we compared what is happening in those communities. And we saw that if you give people lump sum amounts of money, they immediately take big decisions, big investments, and they change their lives very quickly. If you give them little money over a long period of time, they save up that money either in groups or as individuals with the aim of investing in bigger projects at a later date, maybe after a year or two of saving. All those 20 randomized control trials to date, giving us evidence and confidence that this is the way to go.
And do the people who get the lump sum do better over time? Is that assumption now based upon the evidence, or is it better to give it to them part at a time?
So when we give people lump sum, we saw better outcomes in the lump sum arm, improvements in nutrition, savings. When there was the pandemic, the people who got the lump sum had better life quality. They did not slump back into malnutrition or lack of food or hunger compared to people who just got the same amount of money month by month over 2 years. However, there is something that we are also seeing, that the people who are going to be getting that money over 12 years, even though they'd also just received the money for 2 years, the benefits of these transfers were almost similar to the benefits of the lump sum. Because they had the hope, they knew more money will be coming, they had longer term plans, they lived more hopeful, but also that they continue to receive their transfers even during the pandemic. So there might be a world when we go in later, we might find different indicators or different results out of the longer term one. But the shorter term one, we are convinced that it's not giving as much good as just giving people lump sum.
What is the future of GiveDirectly in the sense that if you got all the money you could get, how much money could GiveDirectly use? Because one of the things I hear, and by the way, in fairness to the audience, I know a lot about GiveDirectly, but I'm asking these questions because I want the audience to be able to benefit from Caroline's direct knowledge. So some of these questions you might say are rhetorical questions, but what do you think the possibilities of scale are for GiveDirectly?
We are an organization that believes in taking risks and making big bets. If we could be able to send money to 1 billion people today, we would love to do it. You may know already, Charlie, that GiveDirectly is exploring into use of innovations such as anticipatory action, artificial intelligence, and use of machine learning to help us scale our work as quickly as possible. And we've seen this work in countries such as Togo, DRC, Uganda, Nigeria, Mozambique. And we feel very confident today that if GiveDirectly were to be given enough money to help solve the problem of poverty through unconditional cash, we can be able to build the pipes in a very short time and send money in real time at the touch of a button to a billion people in the world. That's our dream.
That's astounding. And one of the reasons that I've become so fond of GiveDirectly, there's so many reasons, but the democratization, meaning people being able to make their own decisions rather than the more paternalistic approach, all the research supporting cash transfers, even compared to microloans, which was also previously held to be a very effective thing to do. All of those are reasons that I personally and the Life You Can Save as an organization is so enthusiastic about GiveDirectly, not to mention people like yourself, Caroline.
Thank you so much, Charlie.
Well, it's exciting to have you and to be able to hear these stories. Before we move on to things that may be a little bit less related to your work at GiveDirectly, I remember you telling a story which gave the listener an actual experience of what poverty is. And I wonder if you could tell that story now for our listeners, if you don't mind.
If you think about a chilling story, the story of this woman is one of the most chilling, and there is no better way that you can tell the story of what poverty can do to someone and how dehumanizing and humiliating it is. This woman is actually from Kenya, and she had 3 children. Her husband had left her to go and work in a far land to earn some money for the family, but he'd been gone years. She had not come back. So she's alone with the children. She is a sole breadwinner, to say the least. One of the days, she goes out and she's not able to get anything to bring back home, whether it is food or money to buy the food. She knows that her children will literally want food from her at the end of the day because she's the only hope they have in their lives. And she knows that they are going to be very direct with her and ask her, when are you going to give us food? And that's exactly what happens when she gets home. It's getting darker in Kenya. By around 6:30, 7 p.m., it gets dark. So it's getting darker. The children have spent the whole day without food. They've seen their mother. They've seen hope. They're hoping that the mother can give them something to eat. But then they don't see their mother lighting the fire, because when the fire is lighted, you know there's going to be food. But there's no fire. So they ask their mother, Mama, are we going to eat today? And the mother is like, yes, of course. We are eating. Gonna eat today. Mama has come back. And the children are like, nice. Why don't we cook? And she lights the fire, 3 cooking stoves, firewood in, lights the fire, gets her pan, puts the pan on the fire, brings 3 stones, puts inside, covers it, and starts heating. And she heats the fire and continues talking to the children. Why isn't the food getting cooked? We are almost there. We are almost there. Giving hope in a space of hopelessness with nothing to offer. So the children are sitting by her side, waiting for the food to cook. And as you'd expect, they don't have that much energy. They've spent the whole day without food. They're young. It's also getting late. It's time for them to sleep. So they fall asleep by the fire. All the three of them. They all fall asleep. And you know what? That's exactly what the mother was waiting for. That they could forget this story about food and leave her in peace. So she goes, takes them out, and goes and tucks them away to sleep. She comes back, turns off the fire, gets the pan off, throws away the stones, then gets the pan back into the house, and she joins her children, and they all sleep hungry. That is poverty. If you ever can think about anything, poverty, and this doesn't turn your head around, this is the poverty we are talking about. This is the poverty where $20 can feed a woman for a whole month. Because she knows if she loses any part of that $20, she's gonna cook stones. That's why sometimes people ask, but what can $30 do? What can $40 do? What can $20 do? It means the world for some people. It means a whole month of survival for some people. So sometimes I see how people donate to give directly, even in small bits, and I'm like, God bless your souls. Because you know what? That woman, there are many such that are living somewhere, and they're just waiting for your $10. They're waiting for your $30, for your $50. You will change lives.
It's hard to speak after that. Early in your career, you worked with government. And I'm wondering how you see the relationship between the work you do now in direct cash transfers, which is so effective, with the work that some people would argue in terms of trying to solve the systemic issues in the world that maintain poverty in sub-Saharan Africa. Do you have some ideas about how much effort should be put into systemic changes versus how much effort should be put into raising money for direct cash transfers? It's a very different way of thinking about things or working.
Governments still have a central responsibility to make systems work, to make infrastructure work, because people need to spend money in working infrastructure. They need working markets. They need working water sanitation systems. They need working hospitals. They need working schools to be able to get milestones out of the cash that they receive from organizations such as us. We cannot ever discount the responsibility and the importance of government, because they have a responsibility to their citizens and they cover larger tracts of space for what citizens need. What that means also is that we cannot work in a vacuum. We need systems to be working for cash to work. So those who are pushing on the system side of things, they should continue pushing. But we know that systems will never work in one day or in 2 days. They will take time. If you were to build a road across Kenya, it could take 5, 3, 10 years, depending on the investments, depending on a number of issues. Meanwhile, remember, 10 years is enough for a child to grow from birth to when they get to end of primary school, like is my example. If we are going to wait for infrastructure to be developed and then government thinks about how to distribute resources to its people, then we are talking about children who will have grown 10 years without going to school. Those are the realities, that people's lives will never wait for dysfunctional systems. Yet systems must work for people's lives to be complete.
I've been asking this question of lots of people and myself over the years. That's, I think, the best answer I've heard yet. So thank you.
Thank you, not surprisingly,
Caroline, for that. If you look beyond what we've been speaking about and you look at the world today.
Yeah.
If somebody said to you, what do you think the three biggest problems in the world are today? And it doesn't have to be three. It could be two, could be four. And you don't have to expound on them, but what comes to mind right off the top of your head?
Three things. The first one is humanitarian crisis, natural disasters, conflicts, and calamities, which is right now, as we're being told, is going to increase the number of people living in poverty and comprise 50% of all people living in poverty. That is something that we should turn our heads around and think about. The second thing that scares me is climate change, because it's no respecter of persons. It doesn't respect geography, doesn't respect position. Climate change will not say that you've been living in poverty. Sorry, very, I will take care of you. I will not come where you are because you've really been suffering. It sweeps everyone. And we see right now that people who are living in extreme poverty have suffered the highest, the worst forms of climate disasters, which they don't have the capacity to mitigate. The third problem, third issue, third challenge is big data. The presence of big data, artificial intelligence and machine learning, and just how we harness technology to solve some of the problems that we are seeing in the world today. The ethics of it, the morality of it, the value that it delivers today, and how we look at it tomorrow. How do we make use of big data to be able to solve the world's problems? The last problem, the fourth one, is specialized groups. Special groups of people become a worry for me every day. Young people, women, elderly populations. We have stratified population groups that is posing a huge challenge to the world. Even as we look at all the other overarching problems, there are pockets of humans who are facing challenges that are just different from the rest of us.
Thank you. It's just hard to absorb all of these problems. So I guess it leads me to my last question for you, Caroline, which is, what do you think it means to live a moral life? Really, in speaking to me as a Westerner, tell me what you think it would mean for me to live a moral life, or really for anyone to live a moral life. Answer it any way you like. And don't hold back.
My mantra, personally, as Caroline, I believe being a good human being is moral. And being a human being basically means being good to self and to others. Do unto others as you'd want them to do unto you, and be empathetic of people's situation. Show true compassion. Be ethical in the way that you handle your own life and handle the life of others. If you wouldn't want it to happen to you, don't do it to any other person, and try to help others not do it to others. I think for me that is it. Respecting humanity and being a good human being.
I would like to say it's been a pleasure to have you on the podcast today, but
thank
it's so
you.
Challenging to listen to you. I don't know if pleasure is the right word. Your ability to articulate the problems from very personal experience to the macro level is extremely unusual and makes
thank
me
you.
Glad that I have worked and co-founded an organization that supports GiveDirectly, and that my wife and I will continue to be personal donors. And that I hope other
thank
people
you.
Listening to this podcast will have learned a lot. But one of the things that they will learn is that they can give a dollar and 85 cents will reach that woman who is currently maybe cooking stones some nights, and will make it so she doesn't have to cook stones. And whether you're going to give $20 for a month food or $1 million to cover many, many more people's problems, the opportunity to do good and to live the kind of moral life that Caroline just described is available to you literally at this moment. And there are no excuses. And I think one of the things that I like about cash transfers, you don't have to wait for the 10 years for that road to be built. You can build a road to that individual living in poverty right away. So Caroline, I really appreciate your being here today.
Thank you.
And I look forward to many more conversations with you over the years, and looking forward to finding ways to help GiveDirectly in their amazing work. Thanks so much.
Thank you so much, Charlie.
Thank you for listening to this episode of Musings About Ourselves and Other Strangers. Subscribe and join us. Our guests have varied experiences, different points of view, and interesting ideas about what it means to live a well-balanced moral life. We hope you'll share this podcast with those close to you. We'd also like to invite you to rate and review this podcast on whatever platform you use. And if you're interested in learning more about The Life You Can Save and the charities we benefit, visit thelifeyoucansave.org/musings.